It is the Noel Selesky Insurance Agency. Just forget the W when you say the name and you'll say it right. Not that that's, you know, really important, but if I didn't do it, my mom would kill me. So, and, you know, then I'm up here pointlessly. Anita made a very valid point. The most important thing about insurance is that you have the coverage that you need at the time you need it. The worst time to find out what... Yes, ma'am.
Can I make an announcement? Okay, so these dinners here, if anybody didn't have a ticket, they wanted to hear the presentation, there are these dinners available here that you can come get them quickly when they get their time in.
Absolutely. You know, help yourselves. However, what I was saying is the most important thing about insurance is knowing what you have prior to when you need it. Because, you know, if anybody unfortunately has had to make an insurance claim, is this not on? Oh, sorry. Is that better? All right, sorry. But what I'm saying is when you make that claim, you are assuming that you have the coverage. But if you come to find out that you make the claim and you hear back from the agent or the claims adjuster and they state to you, well, I'm sorry, your policy does not cover this. Well, right there, your heart drops, your stomach hurts, and, well, that's going to be the topic of my conversation. What is fault when it comes to insurance? Well, I'm sure there's quite a possibility it could be the customer's fault, but it could be the agent's fault as well. An agent has a job. An agent should not just be an order taker, okay? Now, how many people in here have an insurance agent that they've worked with for more than 5 years? Okay. And how often do you speak to your agent other than when you're adding a property? Once a year? Three times a year? Okay. And that's absolutely fine. But an investor is dealing with a unique situation. When you set up your home or your auto insurance, which, as they stated, it's not a primary part of my business. When I started in the business in 2003, my business was 90% home and auto. Very little with the investor. When the economy tanked in 2006, 2007, we sat down and made a focused decision to to change our business motto to focus on the needs of the investor. Okay?
How'd I work for you?
Well, I've grown every year by between 10 and 12% since 2006. In an insurance business, that's very good. And I've managed to keep my loss ratios relatively low. Any time that you focus with the investor, you're going to have a higher loss ratio with that company because you're dealing with more properties, okay? And we all know, anybody who's experienced with tenants, you know for a fact that a tenant does not take care of your property the way you would take care of your home, okay? It's just the way the world works. We take care of what is ours better than if it's somebody else's. So going back to what I stated as part of my conversation here is the, you know, what you should know about your homes and how knowing that helps you protect when you speak to your agent to make sure they have the coverage. So, little background on myself before I jump into this. In February, it'll be 20 years that I've worked in the insurance industry. I was in sales prior to that, since my early 20s. So I've dealt with people and feel very comfortable in what I've learned over the time of the questions that need to be asked when it comes to insurance. So a lot of times what you're going to get when it comes to an investment property, especially if you have that agent that you've worked with for a long time and you have a steady run of what you're doing, okay? You use a situation where let's say, can in here, how many people have 10 rentals or more? Okay. So there's, you know, 5-10 people who have a majority of rentals. So you're going to have a established pattern with that person. They know what you have, so they're going to jump right into the questions. So how many people in here understand insurance follows your title? So if you purchase a home and for whatever reason you couldn't get into your LLC quick enough, your insurance should be in your name. Likewise, if you purchase an LLC or you purchase under the LLC, then that policy should be written in the name of the LLC. And then you can, if you've done a loan in your personal name, one way you can help do that, help make sure that you have coverage and the insurance or the mortgage company isn't going to try and call you due on the loan, is go ahead and list yourself as an additional insured on the policy. So that way when your evidence of insurance goes out, it'll go out in the name of the LLC as well as the, you know, your personal name on there. So then you're checking the boxes of your mortgage requirements. Now, many investors today, they're not buying with a mortgage. They're using a private lender, you know, and at that point that person is being listed as an additional insured on policy. You want to make sure they're covered. That way, if there is a claim, the check goes out in both names and the coverages are extended to both. So I have a memorized checklist at this point, but if you stop by my table, you've seen this sheet. This is a just a standard questionnaire of the items I need to prepare a proposal and some of the items that, you know, what will help you determine what you're doing. By a show of hands again, how many people do renovations on their properties before they rent them out? All right, so there's a fair amount of you here. How many of you take them right down to the studs all the time? You know what's behind the wall and all of it, right?
Not once in a while.
Not all the time. But if you have to, so then you're going to know specifically what type of electrical wiring you have in your home. If it's an older property, you could be concerned about a knob and tube or aluminum wiring. So knob and tube, they really stopped using pre-war. But those houses, you know, like I'm in an area where the houses were built 19-teens, 19-20s, and they have horsehair plaster. So if you can avoid it, you're not taking the wall down, because it's a giant mess. You're worried about hazmat cleanup, all of that, because, you know, there's clearly going to be asbestos paints on the walls at some point. There are insurance companies out there right now that will specifically exclude the type of wiring that you have in the wall. And it's just like getting pulled over for speeding and you tell the police officer, well, I didn't know the speed limit was this. Ignorance of the law does not exclude you from getting that ticket. It's the same thing as saying, well, how was I to know I had knob and tube wiring in here? I replaced this section and I replaced this section, but this portion's still knob and tube. So when you're looking at the items that are in your home, it's important to see when those updates were done. If you get an opportunity, obviously it's impossible when you're doing a foreclosure or buying from a bank, things of that sort. But if you're buying from a private investor, find out when the updates were last done to the electrical, the plumbing. Another hot button ticket right now is galvanized plumbing in properties. Just because, you know, galvanized was phased out early 60s, right along the same time that they stopped using the horsehair or the fabric covering for your electrical. They started using the poly plastic base over top the, I think it was Romex at the time. But it's important to know. There are a couple new home carriers that I've worked with recently. If the wiring in the wall is more than 40 years old, and I don't mean the fixtures or the outlets, it's more than 40 years old, That's an automatic decline. If there's galvanized plumbing, automatic decline. So it's important to know what you have. And as an agent, I'm here to tell you I have programs that will cover these items for the most part. I've got a little moratorium on the knob and tube and aluminum right now, but I'm hoping that I'll have that back within a month or so. But when it comes to speaking to your agent, always try and bring the most accurate information you can to them, okay? Because that's going to help protect you, and as my friend Jerry here can attest, sometimes you get burned by by not having the coverage. Pardon me, I'm gonna mute this for whatever reason. Everybody decided now is a good time to text. Of course, yeah. So when you're going down a checklist on your homes and the items that you wanna know, the things that are important to insurance companies and how it'll, your hair looks perfect, dude, I swear.
That's pretty good.
I kind of wanted to pull the blinds up. Hey.
That is funny.
So there's basic questions on any application, and some of you you're gonna automatically think, all right, I need to do this, So.
What is that used for,
Kevin? Well, this would be a questionnaire that I've got sitting on the table. I give it to you. You go ahead and just jot down this information, give it back to me. I'm able to put a proposal together for you. So I just call this my proposal worksheet. So it starts out, it's going to be the client name. And again, I stated this, the importance of is, are you doing it in an LLC? Are you doing it in your personal name? A trust? All of these things are beneficial to make sure that your policy is correct, doesn't violate what you're signed for on a mortgage, and at the time of a claim, to make sure that there's no question that the policy is written in the correct manner. Because the last thing you want to have happen is you closed on this property on Tuesday in your name. On Wednesday, you went to the city and you transferred it to your LLC. But you closed on it in your name for the purpose of getting a mortgage. So when you do it, if you're going to switch it over to LLC, make sure put the LLC name on the insurance, because if you closed in on your personal name, the insurance is going to be in your personal name. The first thing that happens in a claim is when they go and check title, if the title's in the LLC and the policy's in your personal name, you could have a problem because there's no, what they call, no insurable interest. And it's a detail that might seem minor, but I've seen insurance companies, we've had to go rounds with him to say, hey, listen, it's a sole member LLC. He switched in the LLC for, these purposes. And it took, 4 months before we could get the claim honored. So that's one of the items.
Why would you buy it in your personal name and then switch it to your LLC?
Because you can't get the mortgage in your LLC name sometimes.
Really?
But so, yes, sir.
What's long as you've seen the delay on getting a claim?
Oh, I've fought them for 6 or 8 months.
I'm going on 2 years.
Yeah, I mean. Well, yeah, and unfortunately that happens. May I ask what the particular details as to why they're wanting to deny the claim?
No details.
Really? Yeah, that seems. Okay.
Scams regarding replacing roofs.
Okay. Yeah. So you got a storm. You get the storm chaser.
Yeah, exactly.
For those of you who have not experienced a storm chaser, be really careful about this, okay? You get a hailstorm go through your area. So what happens is roofing companies will hire a guy with a pretty smile or lady with a pretty smile, say, hey, I was on your neighbor's roof. I was called out here to look at their roof. It's on your neighbor's roof, and I've noticed you've got some damage. You can make a claim through your insurance company and get this covered because they're picking up business for themselves. It's very similar to ambulance chasers with lawyers. And I don't want to, I don't want to besmirch anyone's business, okay? Because my business gets lumped together with car salesmen, we really do. But what people don't realize is we as insurance agents, we don't want to deny. First off, how many people in here understand that your insurance agent does not get to say your claim is covered or it's not covered? All right, so the insurance company does that. Once the agent files the claim, we have little to no involvement. I get an email back saying it's been received. About 4 days later, I get a claim number and the contact information that I forward to the insured. They're then working with their adjuster, whether it be directly through a company, say like a Foremost, which is based in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And you know they actually have dedicated claim bases with that. So then I'm out of it, you know. But I've had to, you know, like Noel himself, we had a customer who a claim was denied based on the fact that it was a vacant home and burst pipes weren't covered on vacant properties. We had to go back and say, okay, we're positive that a agent went in to show this home, deemed it to be too hot, and they turned the heat down. When they forgot to turn the heat back up, then we got the polar vortex, and you know, but we had to go back and forth with them for almost 8 months before we could get it covered. So it's little things like that is the importance of what you want to make sure.
In a case like that, would you go ahead and do those repairs and then try to get the money?
So it is your responsibility as the insured to protect your home from any further damage. Now, my recommendation always goes like this. Document anything you do, okay? I cannot say, yes, go ahead. But at no point am I going to tell you, leave your home in an unlivable state or anything of that sort while you're dealing with the claim. So when it's a, let's say it's a water claim situation, take pictures, okay? Make sure, however you're taking those pictures, make sure that you can prove a date and time it was done. So that's one sure way to do that. You can, let's say you had a plumbing issue and you cut away the drywall, document the damage, repair the damage, do not throw anything out, do not let your plumber leave with that plumbing, okay? They're going to want to recycle it, whether it's galvanized or copper. You know, they're going to try and recycle it, get the scrap metal pricing, whatever. Tell them they can have it once you've settled this. But if a pipe that actually bursts and you can show the piping, rather being in a picture. So I always, you know, document is important.
Another question.
Yes, ma'am.
Exclusion sounds like a really big thing. Is that something as investors we can get a list of or easily learn as we're signing up for policy?
So when you are signing a policy, there's going to be a list of coverages and there will be a list of exclusions. It depends on the type of policy you're signing up, right? So there is a what's called an all perils policy. So when you get an all perils policy, the list of coverages is this big.
Okay.
The exclusions is this big.
Okay.
Well, the reason is the what it states on here, all items are covered unless otherwise excluded.
And then they exclude a bunch of stuff.
And then in the exclusion is what you need to know. Okay? So in most states, it is assumed you have read your insurance policy once it has been received. In the state of Michigan, when they put a stamp on it and they mail it out, it is assumed by the courts that you have read the policy. I'm an insurance agent. That's the only reason I've read an insurance policy. I'm not going to lie to you. And I haven't read a lot of them. A commercial insurance policy is 180 pages. I know the important, like, what is covered, what is excluded on there. But I haven't read that, you know, 23% is covered by this company and 24% is covered by this company. Knowing those coverages or what is not covered is definitely important as an investor, but there's things that you want to look at that'll be, you know, further along. The person who says, I want the cheapest insurance policy available, that happens all the time. You know, I want the cheapest thing you can give me. Okay, but you understand what you get, what you're paying for, right? You're going to take a basic form policy, I'm going to give you a $10,000 deductible, which honestly, I don't view a 10K deductible on a single property to be a good choice. Because your savings is minimal. Maybe 100, you know, and if it's a smaller property, like say it's a property that's under 1,000 square foot and you're covering it so for like 80 grand, you might save $60, $70. So simple math, if you have a $5,000 deductible or a $10,000 deductible and you save 60 bucks for the year on a single property, well, take that 5,000 divided by 60, you're talking well over 25 years you would have to go without having a claim to make your money back. So it isn't always the best. Now, if you have 100 properties and you know that you're only looking for major coverages, fire, wind, hail, the things that are standard on a policy, that's a great way over 100 properties. If you save 60 bucks, you know, figure that. That's $6,000. All right. Yeah. You know, because you're looking at the whole picture. Insurance itself is a wide picture, right? The insurance is based on the law of large numbers. The more people that are insured, that's how they help keep the prices down. Obviously, individuals will have a claim and that may, you know, end up being something that will raise your coverage with a standard carrier. Now, I'm lucky I offer markets that do not penalize for claims. You know, I have monthly reporting policies that I work with through my REI InsurePro platform, and there's no penalty for a claim on there. We do have to disclose, you always want to put an explanation on there. But, you know, those are important things. Some of the items that when you get into the actual coverages on the home that you want to pay attention to is know that you specify the number of units, because while there's only one structure, a 2-unit as compared to a 4-unit is going to be more expensive to insure based on the amount of liability that the insurance company is expending. Because that property number is not changing unless you have personal property included on there, say for stoves, refrigerators, things that are going to be in the home that would be considered business personal property. Obviously, if you have 4 kitchens, you're not going to want $5,000 in coverage. You know, depending on what kind of deal and what kind of appliances you're putting in there, I would recommend on a fourplex a minimum of $20,000 in business personal property. Now, many investors choose not to put the coverage on there at all. The occupancy status is very important on your homes. And I don't just mean when you start the policy. During the year, let's say you have a tenant whose lease expired and they decide to move out. They move out and you go into the home just to do minor rehab, okay? That's touching up paint, replacing carpeting, maybe redoing the hardwood floors. Understand in your policy that there is a vacancy time, okay? Many companies, 30 days, the higher end is gonna be 60 days. And realize that after that time, your coverage can drop. So you're going to want to keep, if you can keep the occupied status on your policy, keep it up until the day before that number because it's less expensive. And then depending on what type of policy you have, you can list the property as a renovation location. So even if you're spending $5,000, just $5,000, which you consider to be minor money, with a renovation policy, you can actually insure that limit. So if you list the property as vacant, you only have your face amount of coverage, okay? So, and we're gonna use 100,000. Everything that I just try and do as easy as possible. So say we've got 100,000 and you're gonna spend another 5,000. You have a loss at the home, you're not gonna be covered for that work you're doing. Switch it to renovation and insure that limit. May cost you, let's say, for $5,000, it might cost you $20, $25. Anybody in here willing to give me $25 for 5,000?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. So that's one of the keys. The reason the number of units is important, besides the fact that you have the liability exposure, is you want to know where you can take a property and list it as occupied as compared to vacant. Know your company's requirements, because on a 4-unit, usually it's 50%, you know, 2 people in the property to make it occupied. And then look at putting loss of rents on there. You can do scaled loss of rents, where if you're getting $1,000 per unit and you've got 2 units occupied, you're still working on the other 2, you can get the occupied rate, put your, you know, loss of rents, say you do 6 months loss of rents, you're adding $12,000 in loss of rents to the policy, and that'll help. Specify, you know, depending on the policies that you use, specify your amount of coverage. You know, if you've got, let's say, a property that you paid $120,000 for and you put $30,000 in rehab, and you're choosing not to do a full replacement cost policy, okay? You're going to cover the property at an agreed amount. Let your agent know that, because otherwise you're going to look and say, okay, this company's minimum requirement is X, and they may cover that. You send it to them, and you've signed it. Again, it's understood that you've read the policy. You know, you read what you're buying. So can you imagine if you spent, let's say, $200,000 on a property, but your purchase price was $150,000, and you put $50,000 in rehab, but the documents only show the $150,000. Well, he insures the property for $150,000 because there wasn't a discussion between the two of you about that $50,000 rehab that you took the 2 months to do. And now, if something's out, one, you're losing the time where you had tenants in there, and then you're coming out of pocket $50,000 for work you've already done. Yes, sir.
Doesn't that become a conversation where you, as the technically unknowing, yet of course supposed to be knowing because you're supposed to read the disclosures public, approach your insurer or your agent saying, hey, this is the full disclosure of what I am doing.
Mm-hmm.
Please take care of what I am doing.
Right. Well, that's one of the things why I asked the question, how many people actually talk to their insurance agent in here? And you heard people say they talk to them once, twice, maybe 3 times a year. Now, depending on how active you are in the investing, let's say you do 1 every 2 months, and you leave a voicemail or you send an email to your agent that, hey, I bought this property on this date, I need it insured. Is it possible for, you know, them to put a quote together if let's say I bought this rental property, so now you've given me the term rental, and then I give you a quote based on the property having been rented. But what you didn't say in the email is you bought the property with the intention of renting the property, and you're going to be rehabbing it for 60, 90 days. Well, then at that point, you should have a renovation policy, or at the very least, a vacant policy. And in doing so, your agent has given you the information. He has documentation that you've told him it's a rental property. This is why the conversation is important. You know, I get an email 2-3 times a week from an investor I work with in Israel. They give me an address, the buyer's name, the amount of coverage that they want or that they purchased the home for, and what the property rents for each month. I have to email them back every time, even though I've been doing it, been going back. I have to email them back every time. Please verify this property is occupied. Please verify, you know, because they own the property. Now they're selling it on to, you know, they come here, they live in the States, they own the property, they go back home and they sell it to an Israeli investor. But they're selling it as already done, where it may be they bought the property, it's sitting there and waiting to go. Would I be at fault if I just went off the face of the policy saying it's rented? Because they're telling me monthly rent is this, coverage amount is this. That's why it's important to establish the communication. Because, again, The time to know you have the coverage is before you need it, not when it happens. So you know that's a dangerous one. You want to know the year built on the home, the square footage. These items are important. The REI InsurePro platform that I work on, it's a minimum of $60 per square foot for actual cash value coverage, which here's going to be a lot of fun. No one can insure actual cash or actually tell you what actual cash value is until the time of loss, because it's replacement costs minus the depreciation at the time of loss. So what something is, the value of something today, 6 months later, it's going to be less money. Then it's $80 per square foot that I use to get things established on replacement cost coverage. Now, that doesn't mean I'm giving you 100% replacement cost, like your house is worth $400,000 and you bought $250,000 coverage. But if the house is 2,500 square foot, I've insured it at $100 per square foot, I'm well over the $80 to have partial losses established on replacement. So there's not going to be a question of the coverage. It's just going to be your deductible minus this amount to repair that item. So it's key to know the square footage. Don't speculate. You know, this house is 2,000 square foot, and then you go back to the city and find out it's 2,300 square feet. On the commercial market, this is all the time. Oh, yeah, it's about 5,000 square foot, you know, 5,500. All right. So he's told me it's 5,500 square feet. Then I do, you know, I do some digging and I find out the property's almost 8,000 square feet because they're doing a cash transaction or whatever the case is. I got a, this just came up on Tuesday where the customer told me, yeah, the property's like 6,000 square feet and it was 7,905 square feet. So I had to run a replacement cost estimator with an actual cash value range. He wanted to insure the property for like $375,000. I'm like, I can't even come close to that. I got to do 501. You know, it's a warehouse. So he stores used appliances, his boats, jet skis, and things of that sort on the property. And doesn't want to cover any of that stuff because it's, you know, like his used appliances are covered by his business, his boats and his autos have, you know, the standalone policy with his home. And then when I'm sending him the information, he's like, oh, geez, it's almost $6,000 for coverage. I'm like, it's you know, 95 feet short of 8,000 square foot. It's important to know the details on your property and help your agent understand that, because if I didn't go and try and find that information, I send the quote in, he's going to get the cheaper rate, and then when they send the inspector out and he does his tape measurement of the property, all of a sudden he's getting an audit, and you know, it's another $1,500. Well, then I've got a customer who's upset at me because, you know, I went off what he told me. Let's see. Swimming pools. These are for investors. It's like the hardest thing to insure. Okay? Foremost, American Modern, J.M. Wilson through their Vacant Express program. Many other carriers will not cover an investment property with a swimming pool. Yes, ma'am.
Do they keep like those little inflatable?
No. The inflatable pools, as long as they are put up and taken down, those are acceptable. But you cannot let your tenant leave it up. You know, like my next door neighbor, actually, they own their house. They put up a temporary swimming pool. The first one they left up, and it was destroyed. Water was everywhere because they tried to leave it through the winter. So then next year they got another pool and they said, oh yeah, I'm taking it down in the fall. It's been up for two consecutive years, you know, but they own their home, so that's fine. You know, insurance companies understand swimming pools are a necessary evil. But I have, yes ma'am.
Oh, I was just going to say, is there a difference between short-term and long-term? Ever have a long-term pool?
Yeah, it really depends on the carrier, and obviously it's gonna, like, market-wise, like Florida, there's all kinds of Airbnbs with swimming pools, but you'll tend to find a lot of those are considered condos or townhomes, so the insurance policy is covering the interior, and then the complex is covering the pools and things of that sort. we have market to cover this with, and it's not a problem. You know, we can go in and we can cover the item, but it's important to disclose that, you know. Let them know that there's a pool there, or if your intention is to take the pool down, great, but make sure that you have the liability for it, you know. What was it? I think it was 6-7 years ago now. You had the little kid at a birthday party, you know, late fall, cover's already on the pool. Little kid goes out onto the cover, doesn't weigh that much, but then all of a sudden, by the time parent got out there, get him drowned and gone. It's an investment property. The swimming pool was properly closed. The child was just too young, you know, and there was a big lawsuit. Yes, sir.
What do you describe as properly closed?
So you're gonna have a locked fence, you know, one of the self-locking gate is the big thing. If it's an above ground pool, nowadays they've got the ladders that actually have slide down locks to completely cover the stairs. Other options with that, like if you have a big deck around it, that's a, you know, where you can lock the gate. Like my mother's has an above ground swimming pool and her gate is self-locking, but then she actually has, you know, a container or an attachment that she can lock, you know, put a padlock on there. So then she's properly secured it so somebody can't climb up the steps just to, you know, look and, you know, have that happen. Separate structures are not.
How about a hot tub?
You always want to, again, disclose it. Hot tubs can be, you know, there's acceptable levels when it comes to that, but it's where is it? If it's away from the main structure, a lot of times it's going to be an issue. If it's something that is considered butted up, like say you've got a enclosed patio, or not enclosed, but a covered patio, and it's in there, like it's sheltered from the wind and stuff like that, you check with whomever your carrier is. Ask the question. You know, again, the point of today is what you need to know before you need to know it. Ask that question to whomever your agent is. Will you offer me coverage with a hot tub here? All right, this property has a hot tub. Can I buy an endorsement to cover this? Another item is the separate structures on the property. So that's going to be a detached garage, a larger shed. Normally, when you're talking about a shed, you want to do it with concrete, you know, like that there's a concrete base. It's either bolted down, you know, it's not going to be like a cheap one of the Rubbermaids that you buy and it's just sitting on ground. That's not going to be even considered a separate structure. That's going to be considered personal property. A gazebo, you know, items of that sort are separate structures. You will see sometimes even where a fence is considered a separate structure if it doesn't actually attach to the home. Make sure you're disclosing these items to your agent so that you have the proper coverage. Because if you buy a policy, again, we'll say it's got $200,000 coverage, standard coverage for a garage is going to be 10%. So that's 20,000 coverage. Now, if you've got a bigger garage, like I myself, I've got a 3.5 car detached garage. It would cost me close to 40 grand to rebuild my garage, put the insulation, the drywall back, everything on there. Let them know what your investment is. Because, you know, if it's something new and it hasn't even hit the city site, or God forbid they didn't pull a permit, you know, that could be a nightmare. Make sure that you have that conversation, or you have a checklist with them, and you make sure that you're getting the coverage you want. Because you can build policies now, right? So I can say, all right, you got $200,000 on the home. Is there a separate garage? Well, I'm going to tear it down. Okay. So we're going to list that it's there for the liability purposes. We're going to put zero property coverage on it. Just that way you've disclosed it, even if you don't want to cover it.
The outcome on the kid drowning in the pool in the lawsuit?
The homeowner was found negligent because there, the gate, an issue with the gate. The tenant apparently told the homeowner is what I understood. Now that's Again, I'm going off of a story out of the Insurance Journal. So, those items, you know, you'd be surprised what things can get denied for. There's a very famous case with Farmers Insurance, and it's not like I'm telling a secret here, okay? Very famous case in New York. A woman had a fire in her home. It's her personal home. Burned to the ground. She got out. No one was injured. Her dog was killed in the fire. She's sitting there on the stump, on the stoop. She's crying in her hands. She's like, my dog, my dog. She calls in the claim. She tells the dog. The woman on the phone who's taking the claim is doing her job and says, oh, I'm so sorry. What type of dog was it? It was a pit bull. Oh. Farmers does not insure pit bulls. So, although the dog had nothing to do with the fire, Farmers would have never insured the property had she fully disclosed it. Her claim was denied. She fought in court and lost.
Right.
You know, and that'll bring me to another point about animals in your homes. You know, I know most landlords have it will have something, no animals, or you were allowed, you know, an animal no larger than this there. You have them sign the lease. If you find that they have the animal in the property and you've given them 30 days to get that animal out or whatever the case is, communicate that to your insurance agent. Let them know, okay? We're not your enemy. I'm not trying to sell you anything extra. I'm working for you, okay? Like, yes, at the end of the day, I work for the insurance company. I play bumper cars. I mean, let's be honest with it, because when someone's upset, they speak to the agent.
Right.
When the insurance company has an issue, they speak to the agent. However, it's up to the agent to make sure that outwardly we address that problem immediately. You know, if you, the worst thing, and tenants do it all the time, they move into your property, they sign the lease, 30 days later they go get a dog, a cute little puppy. It's a mixed breed. Well, guess what? A lot of insurance companies will exclude if it's a mixed breed. So the Well, they'll call it a lab mix, yeah. She had a question first, and I'll go to you, sir. Yes, ma'am.
The question on animals. So, mm-hmm. Does the companies that you write for have to pick it up if it's like an emotional support animal? Like a treatment service animal is different, but the emotional support animal is coming up over and over.
They lose all the time in court. Emotional support animals are one of those items that, again, it's
who
a...
loses in court all the time?
The tenant on emotional support animals? They're the gentleman in Florida. That tried to do it with an alligator. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. You can go right on the internet. Right, any one of you can get on your phone right now, go on the internet and look up Florida resident emotional support animal. I had him, then I'll get you, ma'am. Yes, sir.
She asked my question.
Okay.
So not an emotional support. I can't think of the term right now, but the actual trained.
The trained. Yes, those ones, you get your paperwork, and you present that to the insurance company, and that's, you know, something. The emotional support animals is, it's our type of, it's our society now, right? People.
He has an emotional support animal.
Well, no, exactly, but it helps, right?
Right.
Unfortunately. That's the situation.
Or an alligator.
But it's our type of society right now with the item, with people going out and saying, oh well, I'm circumventing this rule because right now we do live in a time where, you know, the most important person is me, right? It's not, I don't need to follow this rules because I can do this. Prior to marijuana being legalized in Michigan, you could go see your doctor and pay $50. To get a card to buy medical marijuana. So they've used all these items to circumvent, but insurance companies are not forced to take emotional support animals, especially mutual carriers, because mutual carriers have a board that make the rules. They'll do that usually since, say, September, October, and then they'll go into place the beginning of the year. mutual companies get to make their own rules and then go from there. Okay. Yes?
So on this animal thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So tell me if I'm hearing you correctly. So if you have a pet bull, mm-hmm, as a tenant, mm-hmm, the insurance company is not going to necessarily insure that animal, but will they insure the structure and whatever that's associated with, even though they...
It will depend on their underwriting guidelines. You can, with, let's use Foremost, okay? Foremost does an animal liability exclusion. So they will say, okay, it is one of these animals. Now, that list, it's a list, but you know, of course, it starts out with it's pit bull, Rottweiler, German Shepherd, Presnik Canario, Doberman, Saint Bernard, Chows, Akitas are on the list. What's funny though is that boxers are not on the list. Chihuahuas actually bite the most, but of course. You gotta factor in the size, you know. Like, you know, if I bit you, it's gonna hurt a lot more than a kid biting you. You had your hand up?
Yeah, just because you did mention a lease. What if they're violating a lease and have a pet? Like, so much is out of your
control. So you have, exactly, so much is out of your control, and that's where the problem arises. So you have this lease, enforce your lease, okay? Because I wanna remind you guys, this is something I hate, that I hear far too often. And it makes me cringe. Your tenant is part of a business transaction. They are not your friend. You did not put them in the home to make them your friend. Now, if they like you and you like them, that's great. But are you guys going and hanging out? You know, do you go to their kids' birthday parties? Or do they come to your kids' birthday parties? That these are the things that you need to think about. That lease is a business contract. Enforce your contract. You know, if you find out they have an animal in there, boot them. Or serve them the 7-day notice to show them you're serious.
Okay. So you as know, long as you've done your actions. Like, I've seen
you're going, COVID restrictions. Yeah, and that's the worst part. Like, you know, I mean, how many people in here realize the insurance is up 25 to 40% nationwide? Yeah, it's rough, right? Well, the insurance rates have gone up, and we're in a perfect storm, so to speak. You have the pandemic, which caused materials to go up 25, 30, I mean, heck. I did, in 2018, I decided I was going to, my wife was pregnant, and I was like going stir crazy, it was the last month. I decided I was gonna insulate my garage. So I go out after work each day, insulated the whole garage. Well, I might as well do the roof. And so I go up and I insulated the whole roof, and I'm like, I'm just going to run to the store and see how much drywall is, you know. But a friend of mine, right before the pandemic, had done chipboard on their walls. Now, for those of you who don't know, chipboard is actually just compressed sawdust. It's the stuff that's left over. They shovel it up, and they actually make boards out of it. Chipboard used to be so cheap. Like, you know, it was right about the price or a dollar more than drywall. I go to the store, price out drywall. It was a little more expensive than I thought. It was $6.67 a sheet. I walk over, that's the next aisle. I walk over to the chipboard. I kid you not, $54 a sheet.
Per sheet.
So I drywalled my entire garage it took me 23 sheets of drywall. Drywalled the whole garage, and it's 750 square. It was 23 sheets because I had to do some cutouts around the door for $212. I could have got 4 sheets of chipboard. 4. You know, and what people routinely say to me is, well, why has insurance gone up so much? Well, all right. So if a claim happens, it's 25, 35% more to do it because your materials cost more to repair your home. To get a reliable contractor, and I'm sure you all know this, you're paying a 25% premium to make sure they show up daily.
Assuming they show up at all.
Assuming, yeah. Exactly. You're paying a premium to get contractors to actually show up, and then you go on to, you know, just hire a regular contractor. They're so busy that they might come to your job, and 3 days later, they haven't been back because they're doing this job, right, over there that they're only supposed to be there for 5-10 minutes.
Right.
You had a question, sir?
So
Yeah, I was just wondering if the list of animals that would not be covered under the insurance, if that could be a valid reason for disqualifying a potential tenant without being accused of discrimination.
You can absolutely, again, that's more of a legal question for a lawyer. But as far as saying I wouldn't be able to insure my property, you're not lying. You know, discrimination involves the fact that you either specifically do not want to insure that person, or in my case, insure, but you do not want to offer that person space in your home, or you're using a particular reason to exclude them from covering them, right? And obviously, the basic ones are going to be. Yeah, the pit bull question is going to be one of those items where it's always, if you can't get insurance, you know, there's no reason for you to say that person can be in your home. And the hardest part is that everybody says, oh, that's the sweetest dog, you know. Well, they're all sweet until they bite somebody. But the worst part about it is, Jerry, I got you, I'll get you. The worst part about it is that over 60% of actual pit bull attacks are on the owners themselves.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it is, well, and guess what? You can't sue yourself. Like, that's, you know. So.
The owner of the dog or the owner of the property?
The owner of the dog is over 60% of the time, it's actually the owner of the dog that is attacked by the dog. Now, Chair?
The definition of replacement cost.
Okay, so there's going to be three terms when it comes to replacement cost. You have what is called true replacement cost. That is, I use replacement cost estimator based on the numbers, and it goes all the way through to say that it would cost $475,360 to rebuild your home based on materials that are there, because it's based on the actual items you lose. You have functional replacement costs, which is taking a home built in 1950, but using today's materials to rebuild it. So, you know, a 2x4 in 1950 was literally 2 inches by 4 inches and usually made of oak or something of the sort. Now, go buy a 2x4, it's 1 7/8 by 3 7/8 and it's made of pine, right? And you're still paying $9 for an 8-footer right now. So those two items are actually to rebuild your home to where you were. Then what I discussed is an option of a replacement value, to where we pick an agreed upon amount over a certain dollar amount, like $80 per square foot or $100 per square foot, and you have that loss in the property, you're going to be paid up to the face of the amount minus the deductible, because you have the replacement cost value there.
Now, how does that impact code upgrades?
Well, what you're talking about would be a different item. Code upgrades would fall under ordinance or law coverage. So, again, if you had a house built in 1950 and you're going to rebuild the home in 2022, the codes and the difference might be there. That's an endorsement you can put on your policy. You can actually pay for ordinance and law coverage. And then it gives you an additional 20% if you go past your full replacement value because of that specific item. Like in Detroit, it's very common, the homes that were built in the 20s, 30s, 40s have this much space between them. Now they're required to have, like, I think it's 8 or 10 feet. So we'll see people tear properties all the way down and then leave one wall. The bathroom wall, because then they can still build based on the code from 1950. We're getting real close to the end here, so I wanted to point out the last few things that you want to know, right? If you're putting loss of rents on your policy, like if you're doing a build a policy, specify what you get, whether it's a single family, multifamily. Tell them, you know, exactly how much you're getting for rent, and then they can build that in there, because not all policies are automatically going to include it. You know, that
that's a norm with a standard carrier they're going to include. But let's say you decided you wanted to cover your house for $150,000 and you're getting $3,000 a month for rent. Well, you're going to eat that up in 5 months. And if you have a claim, you stand to lose more money than that while you're waiting for the property to be inhabitable again. I just did a gentleman yesterday where I provided a quote for him. Airbnb, right on a big inland lake. Last year he made $140,000 on his loss of rents. Or, pardon me, $140,000 in rents on an Airbnb unit. So if I had just given him 10% or 20% of the coverage, or assumed that was a typo and given him $14,000 coverage on the property, you know, can you imagine if he has a loss in that home and he can't, you know, again, it pays to do that. For your multi-units, you want to know, are there common areas? Because when common areas come, your general liability is going to go up, you know, the exposure. Because if you've got a shared kitchen or things of that sort, that can fall in there. That's something you're going to see more in apartment buildings, things of that sort. Always make sure you're following your codes. Like, make sure you have smoke detectors in the property. Like, my house is smoke detectors, carbon monoxide detectors, and, you know, they're all hardwired in, but I still have to change the batteries, like, every 4 or 5 months. You know, one of them starts beeping. Oh, God, and I swear to you, I stand there like this, looking like an idiot. Yep, but I'll stand there, I'm like, is it this one? Nope, all right, got to go to this one. Because I'm in an old farmhouse, and all the bedrooms are upstairs, so there's a smoke detector here, smoke detector here, smoke detector here, one in the hallway, one in my daughter's room, and, you know, the old saying of let sleeping dogs and babies lie is so true. My daughter, if I wake her up, no. I've been lucky. That girl, she was like 7 days old, has slept in her crib all the way through the night, you know, at least 5 hours. Now she's, you know, pretty much 10. But if you wake her up at, say, 4, she will not go back to bed.
That's right.
And you're awake.
Yeah. I got
it. Let's see.
I have a question, Mom.
Yes, sir.
Smoke detectors have a lifetime.
That is correct.
10 years for most of them,
mm-hmm.
even the wired engines. If they're not changed at the 10-year point, does that affect your coverage?
I have not seen anyone be denied for it. However, you do have to remember insurance policies in and of themselves are considered maintenance-oriented, right? You know, it's the general maintenance. Like, if a roof gets old, the insurance company is not paying for the roof, right? It's lived its useful life.
Yeah.
If, you know, you have a furnace that's 25, 30 years old and it dies just because it's old, it's not being replaced. Same thing with that. You want to take care of the maintenance of the property to make sure that you don't have a reason to be denied. You know, insurance companies are not in the habit of denying you for no reason. You know, they want to cover you. Look at everything that they, like, you know, like, say the farmers commercials you see. Well, we paid out for this and we paid out for that. They're not telling you that to try and make sure you make a claim when a vulture attacks your car at a golf course. They're letting you know the extreme items that will be covered. Yes, ma'am.
Ask your advice on what type and what amount of insurance you would suggest under this scenario. Let's say I bought a house for $100,000. The rehab is going to be
$50,000. Mm-hmm.
I plan to resell it right away
mm-hmm.
for $300,000. I have two private lenders on it for $150,000. And the renovation is going to be 60 to 90 days. The replacement cost is not $300, but
$330. Okay. So I'll take that in steps, because when you look at it, as far as how you're insuring it, it's going to be, one, how risk adverse are you? Because there are companies that will insure the ARV, you know, the value of when it's completed. Typically in this situation, I would insure you for your purchase price plus your rehab amount. When you are done with that rehab, and you're ready to market it, at that point, I'm going to switch that property from a renovation, I'm going to switch it over to vacant, and I'm going to say, what are you putting it on the market for? And you tell me $300,000 is what you're putting it on the market for, and if the actual replacement cost of the property is $330,000, I'm going to say, all right, we could do the $330,000, that's not a problem. Are you basing this total value of the property, including the land, you know, because obviously land doesn't go away. If the house burns down, you still own the land, right? You got to pay the city or recoup your money from the city once you've demolished it and cleaned it up. You can still sell the lot. So depending on how your risk aversion is what you would do. In my situation, I'd first insure it for what I actually stand to lose, because insurance is not meant to make money, right? So when you go in and you buy an investment property in this light, you're looking at that $300,000 number. You're not looking at the $150,000. But if you paid $100,000 for the home, you got $50,000 in rehab, so you know you have to insure for at least that because of your lenders. But you do want to remember the key. If you have only spent $25,000 of that money, the most you can get back is that $25,000 plus whatever you have on the house. Well, you keep your receipts. Yeah, again, insurance is not meant to make money. It is meant to restore you to where you were prior to a loss. So that's one of those items. But yes, I would definitely take it in those steps. As soon as you finished, I'd switch it over to vacant and on the market for sale, and you know, put it up for the $300,000. Or if we discuss, we sit and talk, and we determine the replacement cost is $330,000. Maybe it's, you know, another $200 for the year, but when you look at things like that, you want to look at what your monthly dollar amount is.
In that same scenario, if she's not going to sell it, but you use it as a rental, you would end up insuring it at the price.
I would switch it over to occupied. Yes, sir. I would switch it over to an occupied property at that point, and I would raise it to the coverage amount that we discussed. So if it's $300,000, yep, $330,000, I'd put it right on there for sure. And with that, we are at time. I thank everyone. If you have any further questions or if there was something I didn't cover, please stop by the table and I'll be happy to go over it with you.